Welcome to the Domestic Abuse Breakthrough Show, where we tackle violence against women and girls through education, empowerment, and hope. Join Kate, a survivor and advocate, as she shares insights, strategies, and stories that inspire healing and action. Together, we'll break the cycle and pave the way for a future of safety and strength. This show contains a trigger warning. And now, here's your host, Kate Beasley.
So welcome back to another episode. And today I have the pleasure of being joined by Laura Richards. Now, Laura Richards is one of my mentors. A lot of my work has been shaped from my lessons and my learnings with Laura. Anybody who doesn't know Laura, Laura's ex-Scotland Yard, and she assisted in setting up the Homicide Prevention Unit. Laura's globally for her assistance in many, many cases with the FBI and New Scotland Yard. And she's also been instrumental in setting up in bringing about policy changes as well, particularly around coercive control. So welcome, Laura.
Thank you. It's good to be here with you, Kate.
Yeah, we finally got here.
We did. It's been a long journey, but it's a real privilege and honour. So thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, well, anybody knows me. It's something I take a lot of pride in is saying that I've trained with you. It's something I do hold dear to my heart. So today we are going to be talking about something that is... there's a lot of media awareness, particularly on social media, around this topic, around coercive control, stalking, post-separation abuse, and how family courts don't take it into consideration, particularly if there's ongoing, you know, there has been past involvement with the police. It's a huge, huge, huge problem, isn't it, Laura?
It is. And I think a lot of people just don't acknowledge coercive control in the first instance anyway. I still think we've got a lot of education and awareness to do, particularly because when we brought the law in, and it was a process of over a year where we were producing briefing papers showing the criminalization gap and why the law was needed, talking to victims, survivors and professionals, all of which, you know, 98% of them said this law was needed. But we also said to the government, we must train professionals before any new law comes in. And we had an amendment to that effect, making it clear that mandatory training was necessary before the new law was implemented. And unfortunately, Parliament voted us down on that amendment. So 10 years on, we see the legacy of that decision. And I want to make that clear, because there are very serious consequences when parliamentarians do not accept that mandatory training is needed before a new law like this comes in. And then people say, oh, the law doesn't work. And as you and I both know, the law does work. It can be improved upon, but we need to improve people's knowledge and educate them better as experts. We are the experts who need to be brought in. And then we can talk about how coercive control shows up. And that it shows up right from day one of somebody targeting the victim, but during a relationship, and also when a victim's trying to end the relationship, that's when it tends to escalate. And that's when they try and regain control, regroom, manipulate. And when that doesn't work, that's where we see family courts and civil courts being weaponized against victims. So it's such an important set of issues to me, because we know coercive control correlates significantly with serious harm, femicide, so the murder of women, but also the murder of children, familicide.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, obviously, there's been Claire Throssell, hasn't there, and on Corey Mitchell, which is obviously the other side of the globe. It happens, though. It happens. And, you know, those two cases, both mums expressed their deep concerns for the safety of their children, and the courts completely ignored them. You know,
yes, and we see it time and time again. In fact, Hilary Saunders' work in 2004, she wrote a report called 29 Child Deaths, and she showed that dangerous men were being given contact with the children. And The risk was very clear, but judges still ordered contact. So yes, Claire Throssell's case is an important one. Jack and Paul, who were both murdered by their father, despite warnings. Corey Michelow, his mother Brianna raised the alarm here in America 100 times and wasn't listened to. Then you've got Sally Challam, for example, with her two children, her two boys. She was coercively controlled by Richard, but he also coercively controlled and harmed the children, the boys.
Yeah.
And David's just written a book called The Unthinkable, which is about what happened, that his mother killed his father, but actually it was preventable. Everything, the harm for them, it's the long-lasting legacy of harm for children, that trauma stays with us forever, and that can be prevented. So even when, you know, we get suicides, that's another sort of situation, domestic abuse related suicides, where often we see that there is coercive control prior. And so it's such a important subject because we can save so many lives, but it's also about preventing long lasting harm and that trauma in childhood, children. It's estimated over, you know, 800,000 children. And I believe this is an underestimate, but 800,000 children are impacted by domestic abusers and coercive controllers. And I'm not saying by domestic abuse or coercive control, because I want to name the actor, because that means we can do something about it. And that's what we all need to change.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and obviously on the topic of suicide, we do know that the figures are far higher than what we ever anticipated. I had Tim Woodhouse on only a few weeks ago, and you know, we're looking at, you know, that what's alarming is that, like Sally, victims are being pushed to the point where they feel like the only way out is to end the perpetrator's life. Or do serious harm to the perpetrator, and then they're being punished for that. And when they're punished and the perpetrator's getting away scot-free, they feel like, well, there really is no end to this nightmare, and then they take their own life. And that's the alarming thing. This is preventable, absolutely is preventable. But they need to learn. I 100%
agree. It is preventable.
Yeah.
And if we can't prevent what we don't recognise, and that's why it's so important that we don't just have the coercive control law, but that people are trained on it. Because even when we go back to Sally Challen's case, she did, after killing Richard, she went to Beachy Head and she tried to end her life. Well, there were other suicide attempts before, and therefore it was all preventable when she was talking to her doctor, talking to family, talking to friends. There were so many people who could have changed the course of that escalating situation. And that's what I'm interested in. And that's why I created the DASH risk assessment model, the domestic abuse, stalking and harassment and honor-based violence risk model, because we see this pattern. And I saw, when I was working at New Scotland Yard and reviewing the murders in 2001, I saw that there were warning signs, there was patterned behavior. And I do believe in prevention. And I know that when we implemented the DASH risk model in London, in the Metropolitan Police, and myself and Sharon Stratton, one of my colleagues who was a detective sergeant, she and I were out training frontline officers at 7 a.m. in the morning on their front line briefing parade. On the DASH, we trained them. We reduced domestic homicide by 58%. And that was sustainable over 13 years, 33 women and children less dead, as I call it.
Yeah.
And that is huge in terms of saving lives, but the cost of a murder to investigate it, I costed that as the head of homicide prevention, the head of the homicide prevention unit in the Metropolitan Police. And at the time, it was £1.54 million to investigate one single murder. Now, that is without the trial or any other review around the process. That is just the investigation. Well, we know it's now about £3.5 million to investigate a murder. And it's about £1,000 to attend a call out when somebody calls for the fact they're being abused. So we're talking about huge cost savings as well. And it works. And that's what's so enraging and frustrating for me. We know what works. I wrote the book Policing Domestic Violence that sat behind me with Detective Sergeant Sharon Stratton, who's now retired, and Simon Letchford, who was a superintendent, detective superintendent in the Met. We put all the good practice into one place. And so, you know, I'm just enraged that we've got the femicide rate, which is what it is right now in the UK, but all around the world. Also, this increase in suicides. We've seen an increase in children being killed as well, Sara Sharif and others, and it's just enraging.
And obviously, Sara Sharif's was a obviously was a failing of multiple systems: the education system, the social work system, the court system. And this is where it is every single. It's not, people think that it's just that the police and family courts and the criminal courts that need to be trained, CPS that need to be trained up in this, and it's not. We need early intervention. So this is where we do need people like teachers and social workers and childcare providers, medical professionals. I know Yasmin Fozia Javid, she went to the hospital. She was completely dismissed. They were aware of what was going on, so that was preventable. That was absolutely preventable. He was overheard in the hospital saying, "You and the child are better off dead." And they were told, and nobody did anything. And that's where they should step in. And I mean, obviously, a lot about my case, but that was the same with me. They knew what was going on in the hospital. And these are not one-off cases. So medical professionals have a real duty to spot, even when they spot the signs, they quite often don't do anything. I mean, it's a case that I'm supporting at the moment. And again, the health visit, the midwife, she acknowledged there was domestic abuse going on during pregnancy. She advised the mum not to put dad on the birth certificate because they weren't married. but she didn't do anything from there. And it was that similar situation to me, actually, obviously, although I was married, but they didn't do anything. They identified what was going on, but they didn't do anything. You need to be able to articulate this effectively and communicate this to the people who can investigate this properly. We know you can't stop it, but you can. You have the ability to communicate clearly to the police and put a stop to it. And they don't do it. They shy away because they don't have the confidence to communicate this clearly. I again, with this same case I'm supporting, the CAFCAF officer, absolutely, her report was absolutely shambolic, and that's the only way I can describe it. And even he was a magistrate, and even the magistrate said he tore it apart. He was not very impressed with that report at all. She was very much leaning on the side of dad, positioning mum as the problem, as the obstacle to contact. Mum is absolutely not against contact. All she's saying is it has to be safe. Dad's tested positive for a court ordered drugs test. He's been in rehab before, and that's before we even look at the coercive control, the strangulation, the threats to kill, the family history, connections with gang related activity. His dad's been convicted as well of a gang related activity, and she's complete because he's performed well in the contact centre. Oh, everything that all that can be ignored. The positive drugs test is a blip, apparently. So obviously, I get on the phone to her and obviously outlined my huge concerns. What she did was, because she'd already befriended dad and made dad feel like she was on his side, her report very much echoed that. And at the end, she covered her own back in case I was right, and concluded, as she recommended, a fact finding and to keep it as supervised until we have completed that. But like the magistrate said, she's contradicting herself. You either, if you want a fact finding, you're saying that there's risk, but then in the rest of your report is saying, well, dad's safe and mum's a problem. So which one is it? It can't be both. And that is what we're facing all the time. And they clearly don't understand the psychology of a perpetrator. And as I said to her, that doesn't mean anything to me that he's performed well in the contact centre. They do perform well with an audience. When they have something to gain, they will perform well. He wants to gain control of his victim. And for that, he's got to impress the professionals. He can do that for an hour. That's not a problem to him. So you can't, you absolutely can't base your opinion on his contact visits. But this happens all too often, doesn't it? It's absolutely frightening.
But for me, this is just symptomatic again of the lack of training. And with training about coercive control, in my expert-led training, of course, I talk about manipulation and grooming, not just the victim, but the professionals. And you have to be on the lookout for that and have your head on swivel that that's going to happen. So there are certain things that we know will happen. And we also know about the misogyny, where there's a gender bias against women and particularly protective mums. And the more that you're sounding the alarm, the more problematic a professional might think you are when you're just trying to safeguard your child. When we think about animals and you think about how you see a mother animal with their young, we expect them to be fearless in the protection of their child, their baby. But when it comes to humans, somehow, when a mum is trying to protect and safeguard their child, there's something that happens, and it's called misogyny, where we're turned off against it. But of course, Mother Bear will come out and try and protect their children. And we know in family courts that even with convicted paedophiles and sex offenders, there's a presumption of parental responsibility. And that is where we are currently present day. And women like Dr. Charlotte Proudman, who I support very much, are trying to change that. If we can't get it right and we're trying to shield rapists and convicted paedophiles, what the hell are we doing? And the second part to that is, CAFCAS, health workers, social workers, we know that they get very little training, expert-led training. I hear from them pretty much every week saying that when they listen to my podcast, Crime Analyst, that is the best training they've ever had. Well, that is just not good enough. And we know that CAFCAS is undergoing a review, particularly post Sara Sharif's case, where the CAFCAS worker, the social worker, they got it horribly wrong. Now, these are the people who are making the decisions every day. And if they don't get it and they're not given the investment in training, and for me, that's leadership. I go back to where the problems are. I would say it in the police all the time. It's a leadership issue that you're not training your staff, you're not prioritizing this. And yet we know this is the area where women and children are most likely to be killed. And we want professionals to have the right tools, the right education, the right knowledge. And we want them to be professionally curious, to ask the right questions. And if you don't understand it, speak to an expert who does, but make sure in the family courts you're bringing in the right experts who are accredited and that they are safe and that they have been trained on coercive control and stalking. And we know that that just doesn't happen.
Yeah, and that's the other thing that's worrying as well is what I found, and obviously me and Jen are Jen Claridge are really good friends, and we talk about this regularly. Where they are, so many are not willing to collaborate with external experts that are supporting victims. The ego gets in the way all the time. I mean, even with this CAFCAS officer that I was engaging with last week, I was highlighting the risks, and straight away she got on the defensive. I'm an experienced social worker of 14 years. Well, I didn't put your experience into question. I'm highlighting the risks and why I think we need to, approach this with caution. But it's like they see it as a personal attack if you are highlighting something that they've missed. And that's not good. The only way we're going to save lives is to collaborate and work together. If you don't have the skills yourself, admit that and accept the support from external experts that do understand it. It's
I
really
couldn't agree
important.
more. I mean, partnership working is about collaboration, and that's the only way
Yeah.
You get better at what you do. And look, I've trained some of the most experienced social workers, frontline professionals that are out there. And when I train them on DASH and the risk assessment and coercive control, they admit to me that they didn't know what the high risk factors were, that they hadn't had good enough training. And look, that's on the organization. That's not on the individual. So I always ask people to leave their egos at the door because ultimately, it's so important when women's and children's lives are at stake. And I think that it also talks to the lack of value on women's lives. And, I see that all the time in every country. I'm working currently in America, but also in Australia, the UK, where women's lives are just not seen as valuable enough. And I think that that is part of the culture. And it's invisible because people pay lip service to it, but we have to change it. And I think people are just becoming more and more anesthetized to women just being killed by men. And, the government have said they want to halve male violence to women and girls in their term. But actually, we see things like the Women's Aid chat for domestic violence victims not being funded. We see key services not being funded. And there just seems to be a lot of lip service and, words being put to this issue rather than action and funding and people being talked to about the spirit of collaboration. And even with CAFCAS and the Family Court, we do need a radical overhaul. There's no good just tweaking things. Even with Sarah Sharif's case, what it seems to be coming down to, oh, well, she shouldn't have been homeschooled. That's not the issue
No,
here.
it's
The
not.
issue is the why and how professionals made these spectacular decisions that were epic failures when it comes to risk, that he was a serial perpetrator. And that's the other piece for me, that most of these men are serial abusers. And their histories sometimes are joined up and they're still not seen as a risk. But what about the ones who were not joining up? Because we've got ones who, with Sarah Sharif's case, his history was joined up, but for some reason, there was no emphasis placed on the risk that he posed, and much more placed on her biological mother's risk to her, and therefore that's how he got custody. Well, that's a very flawed decision, but we have to actually look at the real failures rather than masking it. And I feel that we keep seeing sleight of hand reviews where when the hammer comes down, it comes down on the wrong things, and they just tweak things, pay lip service to it, and then move on. But someone like me, who's been doing this for 30 years, I join up the historical learning of the sum of all the cases where we get things wrong, but also where we get things right. But I think the culture we're in right now, in terms of misogyny being mainstreamed and being monetized by social media influencers and others, that sort of climate is very challenging right now when we're talking about valuing women and children's lives. But it takes all of us to create change, not just you, Kate, not just me, because people always say, "What are you doing, Laura?" And I always throw it back now and say, "What are you doing?" Because it takes, right? It takes all of us. And it's all of our attitudes, our challenges, our accountability that we have to stand together. And particularly when you're the lone voice of maybe the risk assessor and you're saying something different from everybody else. And you're the one that's thrown out under the bus, or you're excluded when you're providing and adding value. And that value is knowledge and information that could save someone's life. So why wouldn't you invite that in? Why wouldn't you want to?
Absolutely. Absolutely. We're just going to break for a short interval and we'll see you after the break.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
If optimizing your health and well-being is on your to-do list, then let Revive Active, Ireland's number one super supplement brand, help you achieve that in the most convenient and comprehensive way possible. Clean, premium ingredients scientifically formulated to work in synergy to support immunity, energy, joints, heart health, sleep, emotional balance, and more. Benefit from the power, purity, and positivity of our award-winning powder sachets or our therapeutic capsule range. Use code RADIO15 at reviveactive.com and save 15% off today. Super supplements for a super you.
When you vacation with Norwegian Cruise Line, every day is a new day. Get a taste for Barcelona, then savor incredible dining options back on board one day. Connect to ancient history in Athens and then disconnect completely in our spa another day. Wherever the sea breeze takes you, come aboard and experience a different tomorrow with NCL. Visit ncl.com, call your travel agent, or call 0333-336-1472. Norwegian Cruise Line, Ships Registry, the Bahamas and USA.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Obviously, before the break, we were just talking about how the failures within the systems, and particularly social work, and this is something that I can speak firsthand on, what it causes, particularly mothers. Mothers don't just fear the perpetrator, they fear the system. And that includes the social work system, it includes the family court system. They live in the shadows of an unpredictable system that don't have the correct skills to keep them safe. And they are they're putting their faith in them to do the right thing. And a lot of the time when they realise, well, actually, I can't trust you, that's when they start hiding things. And unfortunately, they start to make things worse. When they do start to hide things, they cause suspicion where suspicion isn't there. You know, I did have a social worker on from... actually, our social system seems to be worse up north than it is down south for some reason. But a lot of people are more fearful of the social work system up north. And I think that's because they tend to, when they do intervene and take children, they don't explain what's happening. Mothers are in the dark and they literally think, I will never, ever get my children back. And that inescapability again contributes to this feeling of, well, I've not nothing to live for. That you know, there's no way out of this nightmare. I have nothing left to live for. And that's something that they really have to take very seriously. You know, that, I mean, that's okay. I can speak firsthand on that. It is a horrible, horrible feeling to live in the shadows of a system, of an unpredictable system. You know, particularly if you've got children who have been exposed to the domestic abuse in the home. If there have been, you know, you've experienced abuse during pregnancy, you are more likely to have a child that has dysregulation problems. And challenging behaviours. And unfortunately, that dysregulation and challenging behaviours puts a spotlight on you in terms of the very system you're fearful of. So it becomes a vicious cycle. It really is a vicious, vicious cycle.
Well, having spoken to lots of mothers, women in all countries, I think that often they believe that the systems are fair. Right. And you expect them to be fair.
Yeah.
And they go into it thinking that the right outcome will happen. But yeah. What they find is that the deck is stacked against them. Yeah. And what we know through research, through looking at lots of cases, through Professor Joan Meyer's work, is that there is a sex bias and it does tend to be the father, even though he may be abusive, he still gets the contact and the custody. And of course, Kate, you've been through this yourself. And there is nothing worse for a mother than their child's safety being put at risk or their child being taken away. That is how you send a woman completely crazy.
Yeah.
And I agree, you know, you've experienced this. I've worked with mothers who've had their children taken away. They feel so hopeless and helpless and they're fighting an unfair system.
Yeah.
And, you know, people who have never been in the system, they don't get it. They don't understand that. But unfortunately, even with family courts, currently 62% of the judges are men, 69% of high court judges are men, and 75% of the Court of Appeal judges are men. And it's like juries. When they're stacked with men, we tend to get less favorable outcomes for women when we're talking about coercive control, sexual violence. We just had the Sean Combs verdict come in. You know, the jury was stacked with men. It's a real problem. And there is this bias and there is misogyny, there's sexism, there's chauvinism. Oftentimes it's invisible. And even as women, we might think that it's not there and it doesn't exist, but actually I'm here to tell you 30 years on, it does. Yes. Sometimes decisions are taken and there is no other explanation than someone's sexism, their misogyny, and their bias against women. And that's something that we do have to tackle. Yeah. And the only way we tackle it is, or the only way that we can, is to make it visible and to put it on the table and to make it clear it's a problem. Patriarchy is a problem. It harms all of us, boys, men, girls, and women. And it's a huge problem. And if we want to prevent harm, we have to start tackling the culture. It's not just about the systems, it's the culture, it's the attitudes, and we have to start holding people to account. So when judges make flawed decisions, when children are killed because of the decisions they took, I believe they should be held accountable. When any professional makes a decision and the stakes are so high and a child dies, or let's say a mother ends her life, yeah, there must be a thorough, rigorous, independent investigation, and there has to be clear accountability and serious consequences. And that's the piece we don't see. There aren't consequences currently. No. There isn't accountability. So why will it ever change when we've got dominant older white men who are the ones who are making these decisions and who are causing lasting harm, but also catastrophic consequences when a child is killed or a mother is killed?
Yeah, but even when it doesn't end with a loss of life, you know, it is the damages. The scars last for a lifetime, you know, and if we are really serious about improving things long term, if we really want to cut domestic abuse by half in the next decade, then we really need to start to look closer at why there is a repeated generational cycle. Because even when the father, and I'm saying the father because, as we know, most of the time it is the father that is the perpetrating party. There are the exceptions to the rule. But even when the perpetrating party isn't a physical risk to the child, the fact that the child is being exposed to misogynistic behaviour, devaluing the mother constantly, the mother's constantly, you know, living in fear all of the time. What that child's learning is, well, what the courts is teaching that child is that, well, that behaviour is acceptable. Again, you know, when an abusive parent gets access, the mother's expected to speak highly of him, not badmouth him. And that's really difficult, you know, particularly when you've got a child who has witnessed things, has seen those things, by saying, well, oh, but daddy loves you and, you know, daddy's a really good person. That's sending the completely wrong message out to those children. And that's part of why we have a repeated cycle that is happening generationally. Either they will end up a perpetrator themselves or they will end up the victim. I mean, I don't know whether you're familiar with Gemma Smith. Gemma Smith's been on a couple of times with me. She's a survivor of the Bradford grooming gangs. And she also got into an abusive relationship where she went to prison for 2.5 years for stabbing her perpetrator. But as she said, the knife was there. She knew he told her what he was going to do. And she said it was either me or him. And she grabbed it first and stabbed him. Fortunately, she didn't kill him. But he got full custody of their son. And now her son is displaying the exact same behaviours as his father. And that's something she's absolutely devastated by. You know, she's got other children to her current partner. And, you know, she did try to integrate him into that family, but it was a toxic influence on her other children. So she had a choice to make, you know, and that is where we really have to, the system as a whole has to look at it and think, you know, look at the bigger picture. If you want to break this cycle, you have to make difficult decisions, unfortunately, because that's the only way perpetrators learn. You know, there has to be consequences.
Yeah, I mean, Gemma's case is a classic, unfortunate gender bias.
Yeah.
Right? Where
Gemma's is horrendous. Yeah.
She's seen as the problem, and that is absolutely horrific. We see it far too often, where there is almost the Davo effect of the victim has now become the perpetrator without looking at the full context of what was going on. And look, I agree with you that the gaslighting of a protective mother having to try and co-parent with an abuser teaches the child all the wrong things, although they are very important to help with the child's regulation so that they don't become dysregulated, that they remain the safe parent. But when you're gaslighting, it's teach and the system is teaching the child all the wrong things, that is a problem. And we absolutely must tackle that. But why I raise the femicides and the murders is because if we can't get it right in those cases, we've got no chance with the others.
No.
And that's what I always said when I was at New Scotland Yard. If we take the most serious and lethal event, and if we can't get it right in those cases, we stand no chance with all the other cases. So let's start with the gold standard here and looking at how we deal with the murders and how we deal with accountability. And that's accountability for the perpetrator, but it's also accountability when people get it wrong.
Yeah.
Because professionals also have to have a consequence if they get something wrong. If we keep protecting them, and as I always saw in the police, the same collar numbers were coming up as the problematic officers. If the supervisors don't supervise and don't do their bit, then we've just got this repeat problem of the same people, and it perpetuates the culture. So that's why I keep going back to, we have to deal with the worst case scenario first and start there, but we have to have accountability. We have to have responsibility taking. There has to be consequence for when people get things wrong, but also for the perpetrators.
Yeah.
And we're teaching children all the wrong things. And look, you know, for children growing up with a perpetrator in the house, or when mum's having to gaslight because of the system, the family court system, and I'm not calling it family justice system because I don't believe there is justice there, that the child learns all the wrong things, and then we do create the next generation. But the long-lasting harm of trauma, it resides in the body. Our biology changes, our brain function changes as a child, the inflammation, everything that we know now through the neuroscience, we're just creating the next generation. And talking and interviewing David Challen, it's very clear that the trauma that resides within you, the invisible victim, goes on through your adult lifehood into the choices that you take. Yes. So I agree with you. All of this is preventable, but we have to look at culture. We have to look at who's perpetuating those cultures. We keep hearing about the police needing radical change, but we're still not seeing it. And it's in every organization. It's in CAFCAS, social services. It's across the board, but it's also in our courtrooms. And I still believe that we have to have a line of accountability for judges and magistrates who get things horribly wrong, or who don't listen to professionals who are making a very clear case about risk, and they make a judgment that has very serious consequences.
Yeah.
But for them, it's in the rearview mirror. They're untouchable, as it were. And that also has to change. I don't believe anyone should be untouchable within a within a supposed transparent system of justice. I think there should be a weight. You are a professional making judgments and decisions every day. There should be gravitas and weight to that, but there should also be responsibility taking and accountability for that too. And I believe that's when we'll see change.
Yeah, because at the end of the day, unless there is accountability for them getting it wrong when there was obvious risks that they've blatantly ignored, there's no reason to be thorough. There's no incentive to be thorough, because it's like, well, okay, I might get a slap on the wrist, I might get a disciplined, but there's no real accountability. Look how much it took for them to agree to eventually name the judges that got it wrong in Sarah Sharif's case. They tried very hard to protect those judges from being their identity being disclosed, and I don't think it's right. There's just no accountability for anybody, and it doesn't matter whether we're talking about the perpetrator or the professionals. This is the only way change happens.
You have to have a consequence, and that's something that I've seen. You know, within policing, when I was there for 10 years, there has to be a consequence for officers to value it and to create that change. But conversely, there has to be reward, right? There are lots of people who do a brilliant job, and yet public protection isn't valued. And I would say this in the Met all the time. The officers who are putting their heads on the chopping block, going the extra mile, who are doing the difficult job of public protection, we must value them and reward them and make that visible. And that doesn't happen. So I think you've got, you know, both ends of the spectrum that need to be seriously looked at and reviewed. And then you've got the middle ground. But like any behavior, and look, I'm a criminal behavioral analyst. If you have the rewarding positive behavior, it's part of the conditioning, but you also have a consequence for, you're trying to drive the bad behavior out. There has to be that accountability and responsibility. Otherwise it's meaningless. Yeah. And we can't have women's lives and children's lives being meaningless and not being valued. And so culture, I always go back to it. You can create the best tools by talking out in the media, by training tens of thousands of people. And I keep doing that. But ultimately, there's much more to it in terms of the leaders and the cultural piece and all of us playing our part of challenging the things and not burying it under the carpet and not getting into the defensive attitude, but getting into the defensible decision attitude and thinking, well, who can help me? Who can collaborate on this? I don't have this skill set on so-called honor-based abuse. I don't have this skill set on stalking. I don't have this skill set on coercive control, but I'm going to put myself onto Laura's training. Or I'm going to see if my organization will pay for it. Or I'm going to read and listen to these podcasts, which, you know, I put all this free content out there. There's no excuse for people not to be listening to Crime Analyst, where a lot of that material is about training professionals, and I make it free and accessible. I also have the Crime Analyst Squad. People can join, and I mentor people in there, put a lot of information out there so that people can learn at their own pace. But I also think the emphasis has to come from government about what's important. Not just we're going to halve this, but it's the how-to piece that we're still missing about serial perpetrators, about cultural change and shift, about responsibility and accountability within professional settings, but also of the perpetrators. The whole criminal legal system has to be reviewed and looked at. And you can do it piecemeal, but there has to be real change, and it has to be long term, not just these 4-year tweak around the margins and hope for the best, which is what we tend to see.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we're just going to break for another interval, and we'll see you after the break.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
If you see the letters AIDA, do you immediately think of the opera by Verdi? AIDA is also an advertising acronym for those iconic Mad Men days. A is for attention, I is for interest, D is for desire, A is for action. This process is a timeless truism for making a sale. Fortunately, if your product or service is health-related, we can offer you guaranteed access to a global audience with a high interest in health, healthy lifestyle and contemporary well-being. UKHealthRadio.com has a regular monthly audience of around 1.5 million health-conscious people. And Health Triangle, its award-winning monthly magazine, has around 20,000 paying subscribers. Find out more about both at UKHealthRadio.com. Let's all put health first.
Hey, are you tired of the irritation you get down there from pads and other bladder weakness products? Tennis Sensitive Care Pads are the first ever bladder weakness pads enriched with a skin comfort formula. The skin-friendly layer in combination with the soft, 100% breathable materials helps protect intimate skin from irritation. And as always, you have triple protection from leaks, odor, and moisture. Gynecologist tested and dermatologically approved by the Skin Health Alliance. Look for Tena Sensitive Care Pads with the Skin Comfort Formula online and in stores now.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
So welcome back. So just to wrap up, Laura, what advice would you give to professionals working in the family court space and child protection space that have disclosure of domestic abuse?
Well, firstly, I'd say check your own attitude, you know, where your own biases and confirmation biases lie, because we all have them, right? It's not just a judgment on anyone in particular. It's just check your own biases, that little voice in your head that doesn't believe or trust a woman just because of her sex. And, you know, often when women come forward, they don't want to. And therefore, I would always believe someone until I have very serious evidence for not believing them. And that's very rare that that happens. So taking someone seriously, where they don't want to be telling you about they believe their child's at risk. So when a woman is telling you that, that's because she genuinely believes her child's at risk and she needs help. She wants you to step in and help protect their child. There's a very high stake when women do that. The other couple of points are ensure that you're trained to understand coercive control and post-separation abuse. And that training, I run expert-led training. It starts again September the 30th and October the 1st. I'm running free training so that professionals can book on. They don't have to pay. And I also run other classes on preventing murder and suicide in slow motion and the DASH risk assessment and train the trainer, as well as stalking and coercive control. You need expert-led training because you have to expect with coercive control that you'll get DARVO. You have to expect that you'll get manipulation, that they will try and groom you and control you too. And many of them are very charming, and you have to expect the charm offence, which is absolutely part of their toolkit. And you have to expect that you will feel empathy if it's a man. You will go into that mode because of patriarchy, because we all feel sorry for the man. We all look at the dad who's got the child in the playground, think, oh, what a great dad. But we look at solo mums and we have very negative views of them, rather than thinking solo mums are the ones that remained and are putting the work and effort in. So our own biases come into play. And I tackle all of those things in training on coercive control and stalking. So, you know, make sure that you're trained to use the DASH. When someone's putting their life in your hands, don't you think that you should be trained and equipped to make the best decisions so that you keep them safe? Because I'll share with you as a professional, if you get it wrong, it's you at 3 o'clock in the morning that can't sleep. It doesn't matter what you might say outwardly, but it's you that it sits very uneasy with when you didn't do something, you didn't go the extra mile, and you're thinking, did I do everything that I could have done? And that's what I always used to say when I trained police officers in the Met. It's that 3 a.m. in the morning when you can't sleep. It resides with you, not with the organization. So, you know, please ensure that you are trained, but you have to understand that separation is a high risk factor to serious harm, and also to femicide, suicide, and homicide when children are killed, when there's finality and when there's coercive control, stalking, threats to kill, strangulation, which increases the risk sevenfold. When you get these clusters occurring, this is the highest risk type of case. And when the victim's fearful, either for themselves or for their child or children. So there's no, you know, knowledge is power. And if you are an inexperienced professional on the job, these are very difficult cases. They're complex, they're challenging. So make sure you invest in yourself. And, you know, I'll end with that. I know there are a lot of very good people who are trying to do the best they can, but oftentimes coercive control is invisible. And I'll leave you with one last quote, which is, when fear is in the room, consent is not. So even though she might be saying A, B, or C, the abuser will be in her head, will be omnipotent, omnipresent. She will always be very careful about what's being said. So if you've got the converse of that, that's because they've reached the end and they really believe there's a very serious situation that could unfold. So having worked thousands of cases, you know, in my professional opinion, women do not lie when it comes to risk to their children. When they're sharing the things that they do about their concerns of risk of harm, it tends to be real and it tends to be credible. And we can all play a role in changing lives and saving lives. So please do your best and value women and children more, because they really deserve your help at the worst time in their lives. They need you to do your damn job and to help keep them safe and keep their children safe.
Yeah, and fear is definitely it's seeds of uncertainty that are planted very, very early on in the relationship, and those seeds are watered and watered over the duration of the relationship, and they may not be able to articulate why they're afraid, but if you can see very clearly that they are fearful, be rest assured it is not for no reason. There will be a reason for it, and that's where your job is to understand the subtle nuances of coercive control to be able to decipher where that stems from. Well, thank you, Laura. It's been wonderful having you on. We eventually got there, didn't we? Laura's
We
very,
did.
very busy.
We did. Thank you very much for having me. And I hope that that's been a useful and practical conversation
Absolutely.
for people. Even if
Yeah.
there's one light bulb that someone has that could
That's it.
change and save a life.
Yeah, that's it. Well, thank you for listening, and we shall see you on the next episode.
Thank you for tuning in and being part of this vital conversation. If you feel inspired to take action and support women, girls, and children affected by abuse, please visit the show notes in Kate's bio on UK Health Radio. There, you can register your interest in becoming a certified trauma-informed expert, specialising in topics that address this ever-growing crisis. Together, we can shape a safer future for those who need it most. Until next time, stay strong, stay informed, and remember, you are never alone.